Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the program today, why healthcare ads will soon be upon us, the rise of the robots, and Dr. X, where art meets marketing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount helps us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Monday, the 16th of December. Great to have you with us, as always. You can forget all that stuff about the White House and the Department of Health and Human Services saying the Affordable Care Act is back on track, that healthcare.gov is doing all right and everything's going to be back to where it should be real soon. You know how to tell all that spin might actually be true, though? Insurance companies are expected to spend about $500 million on television ads in the coming year, because if you run an insurance company, there has never been a moment quite like this. Thanks to the ACA, there's a landslide of new customers on the way. So Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports from the Health Desk at WHYY. The chance to grab market share has insurers set to saturate the airwaves for months to come.
Something big is shifting in the insurance industry. Kantar Media's Elizabeth Wilner says the ads tell you everything you need to know.
The changes that are being forced on the industry by the Affordable Care Act are going to be visible to anyone watching television.
For years, insurance companies marketed to HR departments and insurance brokers. But now, under the ACA, millions of consumers will be comparing one plan to another, looking at price, looking at which doctors and hospitals are included in the coverage. Really? For the first time, insurers have to sell themselves.
Believe in yourself. We do. Go you.
The Cigna. Go you. That's, I think, the epitome of quote-unquote new insurer advertising.
Right now, Wilner says most consumers don't see health insurance companies as hip, friendly, warm, or caring. Insurance executives at the giant firms are willing to shell out lots of money to buy their companies a different image. Case Western's J.B. Silvers, who has run an insurance company, says there's a lot of money in that.
The market's sort of sticky. So once you enroll a bunch of people, you tend to hang on to them for a while. So that first pass is really important.
With so many customers up for grabs, many who are totally new to the market, fortunes are out there to be won, and not just for the big guys.
You know who directs most health insurance companies. We'd like you to meet some of the people who can direct a new nonprofit health plan in Maine.
Elizabeth Wilner from Kantar Media says this ad from a new insurer in the state of Maine suggests small upstarts feel like they can take out the giants.
The ads have very much have that, we're for the little people, not the big corporations. We're not a faceless insurance company.
And maybe it's working. With just two choices, New Kid Maine Community Health Options is taking Anthem Blue Cross's lunch. Based on HHS figures, after the first 2 months, Health Options has 73% of the consumers who've signed up on the exchange there. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Here's an item for the calendar tomorrow. President Obama is going to meet with a bunch of high-tech CEOs, Tim Cook from Apple, Dick Costolo from Twitter, to name just a couple, to talk about healthcare.gov and its problems. Also on the agenda, apparently, the NSA and data mining. Oh, to be a fly on the wall, The United Nations is going all out for victims of the civil war in Syria. It has launched a $6.5 billion with a B dollar campaign for a relief fund, the biggest appeal for a single emergency in the history of the United Nations, apparently. Its last ask for Syrian refugees was back in June. That one only got about 60% of its goal, 60%. And it turns out the UN often falls short in these kinds of things. Marketplace's Noel King has more now on the UN's fundraising strategy.
Abby Stoddard has heard the accusations. She's with Humanitarian Outcomes, a research and consulting firm. She says the complaints are usually made informally by representatives of donor governments who think the appeals may be inflated.
And that the agencies may be banking on the fact that donors won't fork over the full amount so that they put in their ask as high as possible to get what they need.
John Norris of the Center for American Progress is familiar with some of the criticism.
The budget process at the UN is notoriously opaque, and it's a little hard to figure out how they come up with the top-line figures for their appeals. But in this instance, I think I've got a fair amount of sympathy for the UN.
Because Norris says it's very clear that the humanitarian situation in and around Syria is desperate. The $6.5 billion is a combined total of what various UN agencies and other non-governmental organizations say they'll need to support their Syria programs. It covers everything from food and shelter to public health. So who is the UN appealing to? Well, to just about everyone. If you go on the websites of UN agencies today, there are buttons you can click to donate to help Syrians. Bettina Lucia is a senior spokesperson for the UN's World Food Program.
I sometimes say we're the best-dressed beggars because for every operation we need to beg for money and ask for money.
But Abby Stoddard says in the end, most of the money comes from just about 20 governments throughout the world. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, don't know if you've heard, but the Fed meets this week. Ben Bernanke is going to give his last press conference. There will be, perhaps, news of the taper. Whatever the reason, things were all sunshine and light at the corner of Wall Street and Broad on this Monday. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to take a break this week from talking about the not-so-great state of the American labor market and spend some time where joblessness is quite a bit worse, especially among young people. Across Europe, about 14.5 million people under the age of 30 simply can't find work. That's having ripple effects all across the continent on families, social services, government budgets, and how those young people think about their own futures. Our European correspondent Stephen Beard kicks off our series, Jobless Generation, we're calling it. He's in Greece, where more than 55% of young people are unemployed.
In the center of Athens, an unexpected burst of joy. A group of street musicians strikes up and strikes a chord. Passing shoppers drop their bags, link arms, and dance. But the joyful outburst is short-lived. The music ends, the dancing stops, and the shoppers drift away. And from across Syntagma Square, the sound of another, less upbeat busker. A lugubrious tune far more in keeping with the national mood. This is a country where almost two-thirds of the young people are unemployed. People like Vasilis Korobialis.
When you don't have a work, you feel like you are completely useless. You feel like you don't have meaning in your life.
28-year-old Vasilis has a degree in industrial design. He's been more or less unemployed for 3 years. His spirits did lift last year when he worked unpaid for an online magazine.
For me, that last year, it was like I was successful.
Even though you weren't earning any money?
Yeah, even though.
Like hundreds of thousands of unemployed Greeks in their late 20s or early 30s, Vasilis lives at home and is still totally dependent on his parents. The same for 28-year-old Panos Paklos. Armed with a degree in information technology, he also can't find a job or the independence he craves.
When I was 20, 21, I thought that by now I would have at least somewhere to live on my own, be able to support myself at least, maybe support a family. Now it's quite the opposite.
You can't.
No, I cannot. I'm not quite fond of myself right now.
Self-loathing and listlessness for the unemployed, these are an occupational hazard. No sign of such pessimism at this start-up company in central Athens. This place is crackling with energy. Computer software firm Intel was set up in the teeth of the crisis with a starting capital of $70. Sales doubled last year. It now employs 13 people. Co-founder Fanes Koutouvalis, also 28, is not totally sympathetic to the unemployed.
You cannot just standing there and crying that you don't have a job, that everything is hopeless. You have to make your own job.
Fanes claims that too many young Greeks seek the comfort and security of employment, especially in the bloated public sector. He feels Greece will only recover with a new breed of entrepreneurs.
I believe it's the only way out. You have to find, educate those people who will want to create their own job and create a job for a dozen or 50 or 100 other people.
It is beginning to happen. Figures are hard to come by, but startups have apparently more than doubled over the past 2 years in Greece. And there are would-be entrepreneurs waiting in the wings. At this school in eastern Athens, 17-year-old Michael Taliakis and a classmate have written a very promising software package. Michael plans to start an engineering company when he graduates from university. He's undaunted by Greece's record level of youth unemployment.
If you're fearful or if you have the attitude, I will never find a job, maybe you never actually find a job. You need to have the attitude of a winner.
And do you think you have the attitude of a winner?
I don't know if I have it, but I'm trying to have it.
But when you're 17, self-confidence is easy. You're still unbruised by Greece's grueling job market. Thousands and thousands of highly qualified Greeks in their 20s and 30s don't have entrepreneurial skills. And they face a stark choice: stay home, frustrated and dependent, or emigrate. In Athens, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Stephen will be in Germany, where unemployed immigrants from all over the continent are looking for work in Europe's biggest economy. You can hear those folks talk more about their lives and catch the whole series, Jobless Generation, at marketplace.org. There was a story out last week about how Facebook knows when you've typed something in an update, but then delete it before you hit enter. Apparently, they're not so much interested in what you were going to post, but rather why you've deleted it. Anyway, as unsettling as that is, the same thing happens all the time in cyber retail. You consider buying something, a camera, a coat, a flight, whatever, and then wherever you wander in cyberspace, the product or ads for it, anyway, follows you. Retargeting is what that's called. It's been a nuisance for a good long while now, but what with Twitter getting into the game earlier this month and the holiday ad blitz upon us, commentator Beth Tytel feels like she's being stalked by consumer goods.
You know that great Motown song by Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, Nowhere to Run? That's me. But it's not heartbreak I'm running from. It's a pair of beige patent leather slingbacks, size 9. Wherever I go online, there they are, like an old boyfriend begging for a second chance. The same pair of shoes has been dogging me for more than 7 months. Look, I'm not trying to act like an innocent in all this. I know that consumers are more likely to purchase something they've shown an interest in than a random item. And I admit that in the period leading up to my son's bar mitzvah, I did taunt Amazon, Neiman Marcus, and Nordstrom by looking at those shoes obsessively, and that I did, in fact, finally purchase them on May 17th. You know how everyone always complains that the marketers know too much about us? I'm thinking maybe they know too little. If the shoe cabal had more insight, they would not only know that I returned the shoes, the price and the heels were too high, but that my big event has passed. If I didn't splurge then, I never will. It's over. I know that with some work, I could slip this shoe tail. I could disable my cookies or get myself on a do not track list. But do I really have to spend my time fighting off the very retailers who are trying to win my heart, or at least my cash? Apparently, yes. The other day, after yet another ad for those same Annie Lou tulip shoes greeted me, I gathered my loved ones and said my goodbyes. I'm entering the witness protection program. I'll be issued a new shipping address, password, and favorite pet's name. And this time around, I won't accept cookies from strangers.
Beth Tytel is a reporter at the Boston Globe. Her most recent book is called Drinking Problems at the Fountain of Youth. Coming up, the intersection of art, fashion, and money.
Performing surgery on these vintage articles of clothing, and I had to come up with a brand, so it made sense to call it Dr. Romanelli.
Darren Romanelli, a.k.a. Dr. X, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow Industrials rallied 129 points today, about 0.8%, closed at 15,884. The NASDAQ added 28.7%. Finished at 4,029. The S&P 500 gained 11.6%, 1786 at the bell. Companies have pedigrees just like racehorses, you know. So Take-Two you may never have heard of. Avago Technologies is buying LSI Corp for $6.6 billion. They're both in the semiconductor business, with Avago tracing its parentage through Agilent to Hewlett-Packard. LSI was founded by a former CEO of Fairchild Semiconductor, another legendary Silicon Valley company. And thus, LSI up 38% today, Avago up nearly 10%. And that is your history lesson for today. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount supports your daily dose of business insight from Marketplace. So please, help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve starts its final scheduled meeting on interest rates this year. The Labor Department releases its Consumer Price Index for November. And celebrating the entrepreneurial spirit and a serious advancement in air transportation, it's Wright Brothers Day. A day to get your idea off the ground? I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Google buys other technology companies the way teenagers buy a T-shirt, so it's not usually news when they do something. But every now and then, one of those purchases catches the eye. Over the weekend, we learned the world's biggest search company has bought one of the most interesting robot companies out there. Google has swallowed up Boston Dynamics, which makes robots that can run and climb, which is equal parts creepy and cool. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has the skinny.
Google isn't saying exactly what it wants to do with all these robot makers, which naturally leads the internet to freak out about a dark future of Google-driven humanoid murder machines with Austrian accents. MIT robotics professor John Leonard says, please calm down.
Some of these depictions from science fiction are just so far off in the future because I just see how hard it is to get a robot to do anything today.
Here's something the company Google just bought has been able to get a robot to do: run fast. 15 million people have seen this YouTube video of a four-legged robot galloping like a big cat while sounding like a weed whacker. Virginia Tech mechanical engineering professor Shashank Priya says mobile bots could help Google expand its mapping to areas cars can't reach.
It makes perfect sense because you can drop these robots, let's say, on top of the mountains, and they are collecting the information.
There are two common threads in many of the robot makers Google is swallowing up. Their creations go places and see stuff. That means bots gather lots of data, the food that nourishes Google's profits. But Cornell roboticist Hod Lipson says other possibilities are more intriguing.
Robotics has been around for a couple of decades, and it's been making a lot of promises. And often people say, okay, so where are the robots?
Down the road, Google could use robots to deliver packages, help people find stuff around the house, even deliver in-home medical care. And if Google makes those robots, you can count on it scarfing down all the delicious data they find along the way. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
You want to see exactly what Google bought, how fast a cheetah robot can run, which is, by the way, really, really fast? We've got that video at marketplace.org. Even in this day and age of one-click holiday shopping, many Americans will be spending a lot of time in malls over the next 10 days, picking up that last-minute whatever they just couldn't find while browsing online. The classic indoor shopping mall hasn't been doing all that well the past couple of years, due in no small part to the rise of Amazon and the rest. But reports of their demise have been greatly exaggerated. They're being repurposed into everything from community colleges to grocery stores. So from WABE in Atlanta, Jim Burris has the secrets of the successful shopping mall.
44-year-old Kelly Skelton is doing some holiday shopping. Her two boys just hopped off Santa's lap after passing along their list of Christmas wishes.
If you were to think of your ideal mall, like if you were to build a mall that suited you best, what would it look like?
I guess about like this.
This mall is Atlanta's Phipps Plaza, owned by Simon Properties. It's upscale. Stores include Saks Fifth Avenue, Tiffany, and Gucci. Local car dealers display Maseratis. For Skelton, it's where she's always come.
Well, I like to shop here, and I like to eat here, and I like the Santa Claus here.
That's exactly what mall manager Dwayne Herbert wants to hear. The upscale cars, the chic shops and restaurants, even the exclusive reservation-only Santa, they're all part of a bigger plan to not only lure shoppers, but to keep them in the mall longer.
Where we see the value in coming to one of our shopping centers is we want to improve the experience.
Notice he didn't say shopping experience or mall experience, just experience.
I wish I had one of these when I was a kid.
At Phipps, crafting that experience includes this 35,000-square-foot Legoland Discovery Center. It's one of 10 in the world. A few years ago, when the economy tanked, upscale became a harder sell. Bringing in a kids' attraction seemed a gamble for the swanky mall. Turns out it was a smart one.
Anything that brings in customers for purposes other than specifically to shop has proven to work pretty well.
That's Jesse Tron with the International Council of Shopping Centers. He says in the face of the Great Recession, successful malls became nimble. Many dropped food courts in favor of sit-down restaurants. Others added services consumers can't buy online, like salons.
What we're seeing is redevelopment.
Malls that didn't survive are now being rethought. That's the plan for Twin Peaks Mall in Longmont, Colorado.
You knock down the anchor and you build a lifestyle center component on that pad.
Anchor stores Sears and JCPenney have closed. The city and a developer are fronting $80 million to demolish the mall and rebuild. The new outdoor shopping center will feature a Whole Foods, Sam's Club, and a mega cinema. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
We read a while back about these leather jackets. They had Coke logos all over them, and they were selling for something like $3,000. We wondered, naturally, who made them and why, which is how we stumbled across Darren Romanelli. He's a designer who goes by the name Dr. X, and he runs a creative agency as well that specializes in turning brand name merchandise into art. So we went out to his office in West Hollywood to talk things over.
This is this Coca-Cola room where I've recently been working with the Coca-Cola brand.
Right, and this is the new big project.
Yeah, so Coca-Cola and myself created a capsule collection, Coke by DRX.
Coke merchandising, by the way, is like some bajillion-dollar business, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, yes, and the most iconic brand in the world. Right. So I literally deconstructed Coke's archives. We sourced hundreds of pieces of vintage Coca-Cola, and I reworked them, reconstructed them with new textiles, new hardware, and placed those in great shops around the world. Colette in Paris, United Arrows in Japan, opening ceremony, LA, New York, London. So it's interesting for Coke because obviously, they have a ginormous licensing, but then they came to me to do something that was unique and aspirational.
So they came to you to tear apart their stuff, basically. Yeah, they knew that what they were getting with you.
Right, but I worked closely with their creative director.
But tear it apart carefully, I suppose.
Yes, exactly.
Where did the doctor and the Dr. X thing come from?
Yeah, so it's pretty simple. Darren Romanelli, DR.
Yep, got that.
In 2003, Nike reached out to me and asked me to participate in this project called Reconstruct.
Mm-hmm.
Where they picked seven designers, gave us a box of vintage materials, scraps off the cutting room floor, and gave us 24 hours to create something unique that they showed at this pop-up house they had in Venice Beach. And I created a reworked blazer from vintage Nike material. I had to come up with a brand, so it made sense to call it Dr. Romanelli, because I was operating on these you know, vintage pieces of apparel.
Deconstruction actually means taking it apart. Go, drill down a little bit on that.
You know, some people call it brand hijacking. I call it collaborating, where brands like Dunhill or Vintage Nike, Fraggle Rock, all these different properties that I had an affinity to when I was a kid growing up, I've tapped into those, you know, memories. But in a way where I'll source vintage. I'll find an article of clothing from that property that I'm working with. I'll clean it as well as I can, and then I'll reconstruct it. I'll cut it up, and I'll put it back together in a new silhouette. Because if you think about it, vintage, either A, smells really bad, or B, it's hard to find your size because it's not like they stock multiple sizes. So I'll bring it back to life in the best way that I can for a youth consumer who might not be too familiar from that brand because maybe they weren't born when this had a moment in time in the market, right?
How do those brands feel about it?
Well, I think, you know, I 9 out of 10 times, they seem really pleased with the outcome.
And the 1 out of 10 is a cease and desist letter, basically?
Yeah, you know, I've had a couple of those over the years, but I learned the reasons I got those, and I've been able to create a more fluid system now, so I avoid those as well as I can.
You make your money out of this how?
Well, so over here, we have an old sneaker brand. Are you guys familiar with British Knights?
No, but okay.
So British Knights was a really massive brand from the late 80s, early 90s, and the interesting thing about BK is they went away. So British Knights came to us and asked us if we could ignite a big comeback for them.
Hmm.
So these shoes,
God.
So this is just the early introduction into British Knights coming back. We're going to use, we're going to utilize this space as a showroom.
Huh. And then it'll spin out to retail all over the country?
Yes.
Is that the plan?
Yes.
Do you consider yourself a designer? What are you? I mean,
a designer, entrepreneur, marketer. You know, designer's a little hard for me to digest, so I'd rather be creator, creative, entrepreneur.
And also a small businessman.
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is a mom and pop shop, but we're proud of the operation here, and we've been having a lot of fun.
What do you think? Art or advertisements? You can check stuff out that Dr. X has made. Decide for yourself. Marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which the NSA's program of hoovering up the metadata of the phone calls that we all make gets a time out. A federal judge ruled today that the program, and these words are from his opinion, quote, surely infringes on the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. He ordered the government to stop collecting data on the two specific plaintiffs in that case, which is, of course, the part of this thing that's getting most attention. All of it said, though, there are lengthy court proceedings ahead for the 68-page ruling, including what you'd have to call a pretty good chance of a government appeal. And with that, we are done. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 129 points, about 0.8%. The NASDAQ gained 28.7%. The S&P 500 added 11.6%. Federal Reserve meets Tuesday and Wednesday, by the by. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the program. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.